Welcome to the special event coverage brought to you by Curry Coast Community Radio, your community-supported radio station in Brookings Harbor, Oregon. On Saturday, March 21, 2015, the Curry County Democratic Central Committee hosted a special town hall meeting in the Gold Beach City Council chambers. The purpose of the meeting was to help inform the voters of Curry County, Oregon, about the Sheriff's Department property tax levy measure that will appear on the May 19th ballot. Almost every seat was occupied as Curry County Sheriff John Ward and members of his command staff fielded a wide range of questions about Sheriff's Department's operations and the rationale for the public safety property tax levy, including patrol staffing levels and what happens if the jail is forced to close due to lack of funds. The moderator is Carl King, chair of the Curry County Democratic Central Committee. Fielding questions are Sheriff John Ward, Lieutenant Mike Espinoza, and Jail Commander Sergeant Joel Hensley.
I want to welcome all of you to the March 21st meeting of the Curry County Democratic Central Committee. We will start the meeting with the pledge. Terry, would you like to lead it?
Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I want to welcome everyone. As many of you know, the members of the Curry County Democratic Central Committee are elected during presidential election year and then supplemented by infill elections from the committee itself to provide local leadership to the Democratic Party of Oregon, but more importantly, to provide grassroots input to the state party and to our elected officials at the state and federal levels. We do fill vacancies. We have more than our share. We have applications here if you enjoy yourself today and you're not a member of our committee and you're a registered Democrat and care to join, feel free to fill one out and hand it in and come to our meetings and we will give you due consideration. Our agenda today is limited to one topic, Measure 881, the three-year split rate levy to fund the Sheriff's Department. Our purpose is to provide to our membership and to those who have joined us the information we need to make an informed judgment when we vote, yes or no, in the May 19th election. In addition, our members at the end of the afternoon will vote on a motion whether or not to endorse Measure 881. The microphones are not recording devices. They are here from KCIW, the Curry Coastal Community Radio that has started and is active throughout the county, but primarily in Brookings and Harbor. Last night, they were at the Grange Building in Nasika Beach for the radio movie theater. They podcast, so when you speak into the microphone, you will be recorded. And you will be recorded and the public will have the opportunity to go to the website and listen to what you say. You will have the option of identifying yourself or not identifying yourself as you see fit. We're going to run the meeting the way the Massachusetts Bay Colony ran their meetings in the 1640s. Being from Massachusetts, I'm somewhat fond of that process. If you were a resident of Boston in those days, you were required to live within walking distance of the meeting house, and you were required to attend the meetings. Even if you weren't a member entitled to vote, you could choose not to, and they'd put you in stocks, but So we're going to do, we're not going to put you in stocks, and we can't put anyone in stocks, but we're going to sort of proceed on that basis today. The sheriff and I will have a dialogue. We ask people to submit questions in advance, and we have them. And when we run out of questions, we will open up to the floor for discussion. And anyone is willing and able and welcome to join in that discussion. We will have a microphone that will circulate through the room as needed. I'll try to recognize, we'll try to rotate those who wish to speak in favor, those who wish to speak in opposition, and those who wish to speak who are uncertain or don't wish to declare what they wish to do. Talking about mandatory participation, some of you may have seen that our president recently suggested that maybe voting ought to be mandatory, as it is in many countries. And I just throw that out as a thought for consideration. We do ask that people stay on topic. The topic is, what do we need to know as voters to make an informed decision on whether or not to vote in favor of Measure 881 and for our membership to vote to endorse it? Since I don't think today all three commissioners know how they would vote if the levy fails and we had to decide whether to bring in the state to save us. And I don't think all three of them know how they would, what type of tax they would look to pay for county government if they were to do that. I don't think it's fair to ask the sheriff to try to guess or predict what they will do. So I would ask that we not waste our time talking about that today. Our committee will probably have a meeting the Saturday after the votes are counted. We'll probably have it in this room. We'll probably invite the three commissioners to attend. And at that time, we can all have a discussion, if we need to, of what to do. So with that, I welcome the sheriff to come up. Yeah, the first group of questions that were submitted dealt with staffing. And I think a lot of people are concerned about how many hours each week there is no one on patrol on average each week. And when do those times typically occur?
Can I back up just a little
bit?
Let me introduce myself. I'm John Ward. I was born and raised here in Gold Beach, and I've been with law enforcement in Curry County for 24 years, a little bit over 24 years. And some of you probably heard me speak before, and I don't really want to bore you with all the details, but I'm not a big public speaker, but I try to do my best, and I try to give you as much information as I can so you can make an informed decision. But I was hired on in November 1990 as a patrol deputy, and worked my way up to as a patrol sergeant in 2003. From there, in about 2005, I was appointed the search and rescue coordinator for the county. 2009, I became the patrol lieutenant, and then October of this last year, I was a sheriff, or appointed as sheriff. So at that point, just a little background. So your first question was, how many hours a week were there no one on patrol duty on average, and when do those times typically occur? Right now, we don't have any coverage from midnight till 8 in the morning, and that's 7 days a week, so it's basically 56 hours. I only got four deputies, really, on the road with two in training, and it's pretty tough to cover that many hours with just four deputies.
Do the cities typically have someone on patrol during those hours?
There's three cities involved we're talking about here. The only one that has 24/7 coverage, and that is Brookings. But up here in Gold Beach, and I've talked to Sergeant Wood back there earlier just to verify, They don't have anybody on after 11 o'clock at night as well till about 7 or 8 in the morning. They're on a call-out basis. If something major happens, he gets called, and then he'll make a decision whether to send anybody out or not. I know Port Orford, they don't have anybody on during the week after midnight, but on the weekends, I believe they try to stay one officer out till 2 a.m., but after that, there's nobody else in the county.
If the levy passes, Sheriff, how many people will be on patrol, and how will they be assigned?
Well, like I said, we've got four deputies right now, two in training, and I'm hoping if the levy passes, it'll allow us to fully fund 12 road deputies and also an extra sergeant, so we'll have two road sergeants, bringing our total to 14. At any given shift, I'm hoping to have at least 3 to 4 deputies on 24/7. Now, those shifts are going to overlap a little bit, of course. Right now, we can only work 4 10s and to maximize what we have the best way now. But I'm pretty certain that we're going to be end up going to for the 24/7 coverage to 5 8-hour shifts. And they'll have coverage from midnight to 8 in the morning, 8 till 4 in the afternoon, and 4 to midnight. And have 2 to 3 deputies on a time. Of course, there will be kind of another shift or two that will be kind of a mid shift that will overlap the swing shift area and provide additional coverage through the evening. During the day, we have our admin staff that can help out back up deputies as well and handle calls. And I do that quite often myself. In fact, I just handled a rollover accident yesterday after I just got in the door of my house. There was a rollover accident by Frankport between here and Gold Beach or Port Orford. When I arrived, I was the first one on scene. There was a vehicle right in the middle of the road or upside down in the middle of the road, and a young lady had just coming back from college to Brookings. It was raining, it was cold, and she's out there shivering, so I was able to get her in my car, in my truck, and turn the heat on and wait for other officers to arrive. So I do go out and I do cover our officers as well as my command staff.
Turning to the building here in Gold Beach, counting communication and dispatch, as well as deputies and other civilian employees, how many people are in the building during a typical shift, and does it change on weekends?
During a typical shift, and then we got to maybe qualify what a civilian employee is. In law enforcement, all our work is in law enforcement is certified positions. You have your certified corrections deputies, certified dispatch, certified patrol. And we have, I think, maybe two positions, if you want to call it as a civilian. I have my administrative assistant who assists all our admin duties and bills and whatnot. And I have our emergency services person is not a certified position, but so I would maybe qualify those as two civilian. But any given shift, during the day, you'll have myself, a lieutenant, and a sergeant on duty during the day, plus maybe one road deputy, one, possibly two dispatchers, and 2 to 3 jail deputies. Oh, and on weekends, that changes because we don't have the admin services during that. And we usually have, on weekends, we only have maybe 2 dispatchers on duty, most of the time 1. We're down to 6 dispatchers now. We just lost one yesterday. And 2 to 3 jailers, so maybe 5, 6 people on the weekends during the shift.
How will this change if the levy passes?
If the levy passes, I'll be able to add 1 more patrol sergeant on duty and also another dispatch and a civil deputy. What we do in our positions, being a small agency, we try to cross-certify everyone that maybe came from one position to another. say, for instance, if somebody came from corrections and wanted to go to the patrol division, they go through the academy and everything, but they would keep their certifications in the jail as long as well as the patrol, so they can we can dual certify them to keep them working. Say, for instance, I have we need somebody in the jail at the time because we have somebody on vacation, somebody got sick, somebody called in, they can't make it or whatever. I can take that deputy who's cross-certified prior to corrections and move them over into corrections because we have to have a minimum staffing in the jail because of Oregon jail standards.
Will the levy passing allow you to increase the number of prisoners that are housed in the jail on a given day?
I don't think that it's... You want to repeat that again?
Well, I think most of us know that recently the population of the jail was reduced to 25.
Right.
Will the increased staffing after the levy passes enable you to hold more prisoners on a typical day? And if so, how many?
It would do somewhat, but it's not so much of a staffing issue, it's more of a funding issue. If we had stable funding, we'd be able to provide better care for the inmates for, you know, medical costs, food costs. So it's not so much of a staffing, but it's more of a stable funding issue.
Turning more to the jail, why do we need a jail? And what are the alternatives to not having one here in Curry County?
As far as back to the Western days, and there's always been a place to put prisoners in a jail. Without a jail, let me back up a little bit. Our public safety depends on a jail. Number one priority for our community is having public safety. Our jail is the hub of that public safety. Without it, you'd have no place to put your prisoners, no place to put people that need to be put in jail, and no place to hold them. It'd be where, I couldn't tell you what would happen afterwards. They say crime, the old adage, crime doesn't pay. Well, I think crime would pay because people would be out doing whatever they want to do with no consequences.
As we alluded to earlier, the number of jail cell beds were reduced to 25. Why was that?
It was mostly due to several reasons. Number one, it was a funding issue. We were told we didn't have any funds to operate the jail or past our current budget year. And in order to, and there was no plans to fund or a solution to fund public safety. I kind of lost my track there, so say that question one more time.
Well, I believe, you know, the lieutenant appeared before the Board of Commissioners and explained what spaces were taken out of service when you went from 50 beds to 25 beds, and I'm not sure everyone is aware of that analysis.
There again, it was a funding issue, and plus we have had a very young staff in corrections, had a high turnover because of the instability of the position. So you couple that with not having enough training. We're in a very high liability issue managing a business. So in order to cut that liability down and having minimal staffing required by Oregon jail standards, the way that jail was built originally, it was not built for that many prisoners to begin with. And I can go on and on about why. I mean, there was we had a room downstairs that originally it was designed for community work programs, and it held 10 people. Well, that you add that to the total bed space and it brought it up, but it's not a jail cell. And any of you that have ever been to the jail and toured it, you'd realize that it's just a deadbolt door with drywall things that's unsecure. Anybody could break in, out of that if they wanted to. So, and we don't no longer have any community programs. We cannot use that place as a jail cell. The liability is way too high. So we eliminated that. And that was on the bottom floor. You have two deputies, a corrections deputy working. You'd have one downstairs, one upstairs. It was just not conducive to a good environment. So we eliminate that, brought everything back up top where all the cells were, and looked at different things regarding the standards of how they are today and what they were when the jail was built. And the design of it, it just never was meant to house 50 people. So I think that what you're getting at is if we had stable funding and better staffing, can we bring the bed space up? Yes, but not back to the original thing that was 50. I think the max that we've looked at, we could probably bring it up to a maximum space of 35. That's 10 more than what we have now.
A lot of people are asking the question, if the jail closes temporarily, can it then be reopened? Or is a temporary closure, in fact, a permanent closure?
A temporary closure, in my opinion, is a permanent closure. If you were to start a jail up right now and wanted to use that building as a jail, it would never meet jail standards, so it would never be operational. And the only reason it's open and we're able to operate now is because we're grandfathered in. And I've been told if it closes, in order to reopen it, it'd have to have retrofitted, and it would cost millions to do that.
Turning to patrol, could you give us sort of a picture of sort of a day in the life of what is, no patrol is typical or average, but could you walk us through what the average deputy does when he or she comes on duty and then goes to work?
So like I said, we don't have any coverage between midnight and 8 in the morning. And typically when a deputy comes on at 8 o'clock in the morning, if they haven't been called out early, and the reasons we'd be called out early is something priority needs to be handled, like say for instance an unattended death somewhere or an ambulance just needs to go to a place where been called for a medical reason, but they won't go because there's no law enforcement there to clear it, past issues in history. So a deputy would come on in the morning and be faced with probably several pending calls from the night before that the deputy couldn't handle the night before, or something that happened in the middle of the night, so for instance a burglary or an alarm. So that deputy would start making phone calls, going to the complaints, meeting door to door or meeting to people at their door, doing their investigation, trying to handle up their backup calls, and we got one deputy on doing this. Other calls coming in, trying to handle them as they come in, and then once the swing shift deputy comes on, they kind of overlap shifts a little bit, so one could maybe start working on reports while the other one's handling calls, and without that overlap shift, the deputies don't have time to even get to the reports. I've got deputies that got maybe 40, 50 reports down that they just can't get behind a computer and sit there without me bringing them in on an overtime shift just to get reports done.
What percentage of the county doesn't have coverage from that 12 to 8?
The entire county except for the city of Brookings.
Sheriff, you mentioned earlier that in essence you have one civilian employee who is your administrative assistant. If the levy passes, will that change?
No.
We had several questions as to what equipment is provided. One of them was whether everyone who is on patrol or is called out, whether they have protective clothing.
It's our policy that all our road patrol deputies wear protective vests, and we have to be able to provide that. I would not send them out there without that protection. Our vests that we provide to our deputies have a shelf life of about 5 years, and then they have to be replaced. We're at the end of that shelf life currently, so we have to look at replacing the deputies' vests we have, and plus hiring another six deputies to be on the road. We'd have to outfit them as well, not only with the vests, but fully equipped patrol cars, duty weapons, the long guns, the handguns, tasers, less lethal shotgun beanbags, and then training an officer is up. It costs $20,000 to train an officer at the academy.
Approximately how much does it cost to put a new patrol deputy in a vehicle, counting the vehicle and the equipment?
Probably about 70 grand.
That's counting the training as well?
Yes.
There are questions as to, and I'm not sure whether these really belong to you or to the commissioners, but how was the split rate determined?
The split rate was determined, and when I first started this, when I became sheriff in October, I talked to the commissioners then and asked if there was any solutions to fund us past the 2014-2015 budget. There really wasn't anything. There was some ideas, but nothing solid. And we're always looking at kicking the can down the road, so to speak, as far as every year trying to figure out where we're going to get the next dollar to fund the sheriff's office or fund law enforcement adequately. So my idea was, looking at talking to people from around the state and the Lieutenant Espinoza that came from Deschutes County, talked to him about how Deschutes County's model worked with a permanent law enforcement district, where it's permanent funding and we don't have to worry about from year to year to year. So I needed to figure out how we could get our own public safety district and get that form. In order to do so, I had to have help. So I enlisted the citizens, went to the citizens and made a plea, say, hey, this is my idea. I need people who would be willing to step up and help me form a district. Several applications came in for that. We reviewed the application, designed a citizens advisory board group, so to speak, and we set forth to work on getting public safety district. We soon found out after we started that it wasn't quite capable to put a district on the ballot for this May to get us through to another budget year due to the timelines and the regulations and requirements it takes to form a district. So an alternative plan had to be developed, and that was to put this three-year local option tax to the voters to make it a bridge to get us to the district. And I know Commissioner Susan Brown back there and I had several talks, and she put a survey out to see what the citizens would support. And what I understand, I haven't seen the complete results, but it was a pretty good support, overwhelming support for the sheriff's office itself, and that they would support a public safety district. But unable to get there, we had to form this taxing levy request, and we had to get the citizens or the cities on board in order to get this thing passed. So I enlisted the help of all three of the city mayors. In fact, all three were on our citizen advisory board. And in order to make, and like I say, get them on board, the cities on board, we had to make it a fair across the board. So in order to do that, a split rate was decided to go for a split rate. The split rate would be $1.34 across the board for county and city, the incorporated and unincorporated, to pay for everything like the civil, Marine Patrol, Forest Patrol, their jail, corrections, and a few others. Everything except for road patrol, because the cities already pay for their road patrol. And some of them pay pretty good prices. Looking at Brookings, they pay $2.80 per thousand in the city limits for their their patrol coverage. We pay 59 cents right now. Port Orford pays $2.90 per thousand for their patrol coverage, and Gold Beach, I know, is over $2, but I'm not sure exactly what the number is. And so in order to get road patrol covered in the unincorporated areas, we added on another $1.18 and brought that from $1.34 for the unincorporated to $2.52. And that's going to be able to provide 24/7 patrol coverage.
So the difference is just the cost of patrol.
The cost of patrol, and that'd be unincorporated paying $1.18 per thousand for a patrol.
I'll add another. Those of you who remember the first split levy, we in the unincorporated area were going to pay 90% of the cost of search and rescue, because after all, most people who needed to be searched for got lost in the unincorporated areas, not in downtown Brookings.
Well, in fact, we just had a little 11-year-old boy got lost in downtown Brookings. And
that's true. And now, the rates are maximum rates, as I understand it, and lower rates are possible depending on the budget set for each fiscal year under the levy. Who sets the actual rate that the taxpayers will pay each year?
I have nothing to do with that, except for maybe being on some advisory to that. But the county commissioners are the governing board, and they will set those rates. And I would think be assisted by the citizens advisory group that developed the 3-year levy. And it would kind of be a combination of the two to set the rates. Is that correct, Susan?
Now, those who watch the budget process or read the budget, it's an exciting document. I recommend it highly. The next time you have insomnia, you will notice that certain departments that provide services to all the other departments, if you will, the overhead departments, their costs are allocated on a square footage or employee or budget amount basis to the other departments. And for example, the road department has allocated to it a portion of the cost of the treasurer's office, the assessor's office, the clerk's office, and the like, and as of last year, the commissioner's office. Will that also take place with respect to the funds raised under this levy?
Yes. The funds that are raised go 100% to the sheriff's office for sheriff's office function, and part of that function is paying for services that we have to have. We have to have payroll services. We have to have the commissioner's services. Finance, county council, occupancy, we still have to pay for what we use. So, but the rest of the money or any other money will not go to any other department. You know, if the commissioners can't take part of it and supplement some other place, so
they can't increase their expenses for travel more than they did last year.
That's unless it's part built into our services.
Those are the questions we had submitted to us in advance, and given that this is an informational meeting and we weren't setting this up as a gotcha session for the sheriff, we hadn't intended to entertain questions from the floor, but if the sheriff's willing and somebody has a question that, again, keeps on topic, we have plenty of time, and you're welcome to stand up and take the microphone and ask the question.
This isn't so much a question as a comment. First, thanks for joining us. Mm-hmm. My name is Beverly Basic. Jim and I are homeowners in Port Orford, but we happen to live just outside of the city limits, so we are in the unincorporated area. Okay. So if this levy passes, we would be paying the higher of the two tier. Our property is valued around $100,000, so what we're calculating is with this levy, we'd probably be paying about a little over another $20 a month for our law enforcement services. That seems so minimal to me, and I know a lot of people are concerned about big increases in their property tax bill, but at $100,000, having another $20 a month that we would be paying to provide all of this and to go from no coverage at all at our house from midnight to 8 o'clock in the morning, 7 days a week, to having coverage is invaluable to us. Just knowing that we have coverage is invaluable. Certainly enough that one trip for the two of us to Subway for sandwiches and sodas and a bags of chips, I mean, it just to us, it's a no-brainer. So you have our enthusiastic support for this levy. Nobody loves to pay taxes, but everybody wants public services. So we both intend to promote, encourage, persuade, and vote for this levy in May.
Thank you. And let me just comment on that. As the chief law enforcement officer in the county, the sheriff is responsible for all citizens in the county. And I take that very seriously. My command staff and I also take it very seriously. And if this passes and I do get the staffing that I like, I will have, you know, at least three on per shift, and sometimes maybe a little more. And I want to be able to show up at your door when you call and say, hey, I need you, and not have to call the supervisor in the middle of the night and say, I don't have anybody on. This is going on. What do I do? You know.
I'll have coffee ready for you.
I think Beverly has now put us in the second part of our meeting, which is discussion. And I view her comments as positive. If anyone wishes to speak in opposition, they're welcome to do so now. Or if somebody wishes to speak who is undecided or ask the sheriff a question on topic that has been asked, please do.
If you're in opposition, I'll be waiting outside with a...
Skip Hunter.
Hi, Skip.
How you doing?
Good.
Frankly, I'm embarrassed that you have to be here to try to sell the idea of a tax levy for law enforcement in our community. Your job is tough enough as it is without having to worry about your financial future. And I've heard a few people say, well, I've got a gun and I've got a dog. I don't need law enforcement. Well, you better have a lot of money in the bank, too, because you could be criminally liable or civilly liable if you hurt someone or your dog hurts someone. You could lose everything you own. And by the way, we have this street out here called Highway 101 who runs through the main street of every town in this county. And you've got all kinds of people, both non-criminals and criminals, traveling up and down the West Coast through that artery, and they can stop off anywhere along the way. They're not just somebody in your neighborhood. And I tell you, the fact that you guys even have to worry about this, I find very disconcerting. We have a very professional law enforcement community. I'm very proud of the job they do with the limited amount of funds that they have, and I definitely support Sheriff Ward. Thank you.
I'm glad you brought that point up. It is not the sheriff's position or the responsibility to fund the sheriff's office. My responsibility is to run the sheriff's office and provide the best public safety that I possibly can with what is provided to me. It's the job of the commissioners to do to find funding for our office. I'd love to be able to just come in and not worry about where the funds come in. And I just want to do my job. I'm more of a hands-on type of guy. I like to get out there and get my hands dirty. Being a politician is not very well what it's all cracked up to be. And I got to hand it to Susan and the commissioners. They were dealt a hand too. And they didn't cause this mess. This has been coming for a long time. And we're just trying to do the best we can. And we all need to do what we can to fix this problem.
Hi, my name is Sharon Crimes, and I was just curious, if this passes, which I hope everybody supports it, what's going to happen after the 3 year?
Well, what are your plans? Getting back to what our original goal was, to form a public safety district, which is a permanent funding. Just like if you look at your tax bill, only a small portion goes to general fund. And I can give you examples using my own bill. My bill is almost $1,200 a year for a two-bedroom, one-bath home and 2 acres. And only $82 of that is going to county services. And out of that county services, 60% of that goes to law enforcement. So my assessed value is $137,000 on my house. I pay roughly $4.08 a month for law enforcement services for the county. You look at what else I pay for the rest of the bill, I mean, which the commissioners or the county has no control over. It's all those other pass-through funds that go to your health district, your fire district, your library, your cemetery districts, and everything. Only a small portion is going to county services. Did that answer your question? Or?
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, do you think you'll be back in 3 years?
Oh. So, yeah, the reason we went for this public safety local option tax is to get us to, while we're, if that passes, we're still going to be working on the permanent funding for the district. And if we can get that passed, when the three-year levy expires, it'll just take in effect. And we tried to form this law enforcement tax and fund it the way we'd possibly fund the district. So there was no big changes or everything, and I think, you know, we're pretty close to that.
Sheriff Ward, Terry Brayer. During the last levy and during discussions leading up to this one, there's been talk in regards to the 9/11 services and combining both Brookings and the counties. Could you address that issue and the savings, if it were to occur, or why it could not occur?
Correct me if I'm wrong, Susan, but we've been talking this for like 15 years about consolidation 911 and possible savings. I haven't, you know, I'd love to see it consolidated at some point where, but it has to be equitable and be able to, the county, not cost the county a lot of money. Right now, if we're talking about consolidation, really, I see it, the only way we could do it is if we consolidated here. The county owns the towers, we have all the infrastructure, and we cannot just, you know, say if we take the dispatch out, we still have to have the same amount of people in dispatch to run the jail because they are command and control of the jail. They watch the monitors and they key the buttons and click the doors to let people in and out, and they're kind of a safety line for the two corrections officers up there dealing with the issues. And Lieutenant Espinosa can tell you the same thing. When we get the prisoners, we get them at their worst, right off the street. They're coming from a domestic violence or something, or they're intoxicated, or they're just angry. And when we get them, we're constantly dealing with that kind of stuff. And time we get them in there, we get them medicated, we get them calmed down and everything. And then if they get moved out to a different facility, they're on a stable road there. So, but we see everything at its worst. And consolidating 911, the only thing I believe, and I've talked to the past sheriff about this, the only way it would save the county money if we consolidated it up here, because we have the infrastructure. And possible savings of maybe $300,000 a year.
Hi, Nick Hammond from Brookings.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, you talked about the county, the jail and the condition that it's in. What are going to be the cost of upgrades to bring it up to functional? And how would that serve as a savings in the long run?
Well, this jail will never, ever meet Oregon jail standards. There's the American Disabilities Act. We don't have for handicap accessibility. We would never be able to retrofit the jail to fix that. The jail has no natural lighting in there, which the jail, today's jail standards say you have to have. In order to bring this back up, it's going to, like I say, going to cost millions. But we can deal with it as long as we don't shut it down to begin with. We can maybe add a little bit of money here and there to fix things.
Would it be better to build new instead of throw money away? I'm looking at long-term costs.
Yeah.
People start talking about budgets, it's going to get long.
Well, I don't think this county's really ever going to need a facility that's a 100-bed facility like some of these other ones, you know. Yeah. Yeah, it'd be nice to have a different jail and a courthouse and everything, because that thing, the whole thing is old, and build it somewhere else and be a functional jail. It'd be the liabilities that would take huge liabilities away from us. Saving insurance and all kinds of things.
Hi, Bob Curry from Brookings.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding this jail subject, can you tell us a little bit about the release of prisoners because of lack of space? And also, what would happen in the event that this levy fails? At what point could the jail be reopened, or would it have to go back through, start all over again, like you said earlier? I guess that's about it.
Well, when we took it down to 25 beds, we developed the new policies and a what's that word, Joel? Instead of a matrix, it's a
risk assessment.
And you want to talk about that a little bit, or
I can.
Joel is Sergeant Hensley from he's my jail commander, so he has a little bit more in tune to the jail operations.
Before, in the past, whenever we had to look at who we were going to release, we kind of had just to make a guesstimation, or, you know, we didn't really have anything firm down of like what's this person's risk of reoffending, or what's their risk to the public safety. What we developed through the help of other counties, Benton County was very fundamental in it, was a risk assessment. It takes into a person's criminal history, their failure to appear, their crime seriousness level. Depending on what their crimes are, it's assigned a number. From that number, we can add up all the other numbers of, like I said, their criminal history, and that falls into how many felonies they have. Like four or more is assigned the highest number. One is assigned the least number. Misdemeanors, how many different misdemeanors they have. So from all those numbers, you combine it with your totality of the current charges, and each crime that they are alleged to commit are all assigned this number. So from there, it becomes a numbering system. The worst stay in jail, the lower numbers do get released. Sometimes people see somebody that's been yelling and screaming in the street. That crime is called disorderly conduct. It can be troubling and alarming to people to see. But unfortunately, on the scheme of things, compared to possession of a methamphetamine, burglary, or a theft, it falls much lower on the scale. So the person that's committed that disorderly conduct. But part of our risk assessment also takes into a person there, if they're under the influence of intoxicants. Part of our policy is now, we do not release them until that they are totally sober and aware of what's going on to be able to complete the booking process. Back probably 15 years ago, because we had detox whenever I first started. Everybody's heard of the drunk tank. Well, we used to have detox. It was civil. They'd bring them in, say, this guy's drunk, and we'd throw them in. Legally, we cannot do that. The only people we hold in jail are people that have been have alleged to commit a crime or are found guilty or sentenced under crimes, not violations. Speeding tickets are your violations, running stop signs, those are violations. Crimes are the only things to be held in jail. Before, under the civil, they were just saying, oh, he's drunk. He hadn't committed a crime. He was just out in public being intoxicated. So they took that away because the liability on the jails was huge. People that are impaired do some of the dumbest things. They'll climb the bars, they'll bang their head, they'll get in a fight with another person. They can't even sometimes orientate themselves to what's around. So if someone's arrested for a crime, brought, they are impaired. They will stay, our jail will watch them, they'll monitor them. Whenever they know what's going on and stuff, then we'll release them. But that's all under this system. It's been referred to as a matrix, but sometimes people are envisioning the movie Matrix, or, you know, and it's hard to explain or wrap your head around. But a matrix, it just means a numbering system, and this is what it is. You can even call it an algorithm, but it's not. It's a numbering system. Then we have a spreadsheet so that anytime, any day or night, I don't have to be called and say, hey, Joel, you know, we have this, this, and this. Who should we release? My jail can go right through and look at stuff. There are crimes where people will not be released. Domestic violence, they will not be released. Well, treason, they won't be released either. Murders, anybody who has alleged to commit a Measure 11 crime, if people are you guys aware of what Measure 11 is? I believe it was passed in 1997 in regards to, it was passed by the voters, that there will be certain mandatory sentences for some of the worst believed to be crimes. They're your murders, rapes, robberies, and assaults. I think I'm forgetting some in there. Kidnapping. But anyways, Measure 11 crimes, they will not be released. They're still assigned a score, so we know where we can house them, because part of what we do is also classification. We can't put somebody that's committed their first time DUII with someone that's been accused of rape or murder. You can't do that. I mean, that's the one, it's against the law. Two, it's a huge liability and be damaging to somebody that may have just made a poor choice in life and wants to change their life. Put them with somebody that's alleged to commit such a serious crime, that'd be horrible. So this matrix risk assessment algorithm takes all this into consideration. So from all of this, it will generate, restraining order violation. Somebody commits violates an order of the court, which is to stay away from another person, they will also remain in jail. So our theory was, and the theories of other counties, is that under this policy and procedure, we will keep the worst of the worst in jail. I'd like to expand a little bit what the sheriff was talking about, as our jail was never designed for 50 beds. Unfortunately, I don't know what caused it, but everybody wanted to say how much jail bed space they had. So we were counting our visitation as a housing unit, our booking room as a housing unit, our holding cells as a housing unit. They're not a housing unit. They don't have a toilet. The drunk tank is what is now the holding area. It's just, I think it's
6x8.
Yeah, 6x8 cell that has a drain in the bottom. And we are what's called a linear jail design. If you guys ever watch Lockup and stuff like that, whenever they start showing jails back east that are built in the 1800s, old brick buildings with the bars in every cell, or like San Quentin, that's called a linear jail design. That's what we are. We're not an open podular design or direct supervision where you would have one guard guarding 40 or 50 inmates. Our facility is a lot more labor intensive. We need to use keys every time we open. And for like any inmate movement, would take probably four key movements, opening, closing a door, escorting the inmate to another area, opening, closing a door, then to another area, just to move them within the facility. So for medical, attorney visits, visitation, any of that stuff, that's when those all those movements would happen. So our jail is just, they wanted to pump that number up. Then in the early 2000s, a thing called Prison Rape Elimination Act happened. It's a federal standard where they haven't made it a mandate yet, but it's a Prison Rape Elimination Act, or we refer to it as PREA. So if you read about it, this is what PREA is. We cannot subject anybody else to us just viewing them using the toilet facilities or showering. They shouldn't be subjected to another inmate using the toilet or showering, or prevent them from being sexually abused, assaulted by either inmates or staff, or any other staff that we have. So under PREA, we had in our max and north wing cell areas, we had two bunks. The toilet is literally a foot and a half, 2 feet away from the lower bunk. So anytime the gentleman in the upper bunk was using the toilet, the person down below's head would literally be right there. So we removed those bunks just because under PREA, our liability. And when you get two people alleged to commit certain crimes, and they're coming down on methamphetamine, they're coming down on some other narcotics, they do not, for lack of a better term, play well. So you can't house them together. So even if we had two bunks in each one, we still would not have two people in there at all times. Our basic population was right around 40s, whenever they advertised us as having 50 beds. It has been more noticed now of how many we are releasing. But I am more than happy to discuss with anyone of why we release people and why we've kept certain people. I've had people stop me on the street and say, I can't believe you let that guy go. But then I explained to them, well, we had to let that individual go, but we kept this one.
Real quickly hit on the mental portion, mental illness.
Well, that could be its own topic all on its own. The state of Oregon does not have a lot of mental health facilities. They just don't have a lot of inpatient. They don't have a lot of places for people to go that are dangerous to themselves or others. Unfortunately, people that are going through mental crisis will end up coming into contact with law enforcement, whether they're trying to hurt themselves or they have alleged to committed a crime. Sometimes the officer thinks this is the best way for me to protect this person, or protect the other people around is by taking them into custody. We end up with them. We are not built to handle any of these people. So what we do is we actually have a really good working relationship with our local mental health facility. But we're not built to design to hold people. I mean, I've had people self-harm themselves. We've had to take them to the hospital. But even then, there's nowhere for them to go. So they end up being reintroduced into this society with limited medications, whether or not they trade them for drugs or not, or sell them, or they're stolen from them, we end up having them back. So we continually try to offer counseling. We train our officers how to deal with people in crisis to try to intervene, I guess, and try to get people back onto the right track. We find that a lot of our people suffer from diagnosed mental health problems. We had a gentleman in town who was a chronic disorderly conduct. He was a chronic criminal trespasser. We had him in for off and on for a year. He would come, spend some days under our risk assessment. He would go out, but he would come in. If our population was down, he would stay. He would get put back out. He would consume alcohol, come back. So we found out he actually had schizophrenia. We found out that we had a family member that was willing to take him on and help him and get guardianship and take care of him. So through our jail and through the sheriff backing us on it, we went and we were able to get this person the treatment that they needed. We went ahead, as the sheriff has authority over the prisoners, and he's allowed me to make certain decisions on releases. We decided to release him to these other family members in under care. A secured transport arrived, took him to a care facility where temporary guardianship was placed. And from what I understand, the guardianship has taken effect. The gentleman's medicated. He's receiving treatment, and I don't plan on seeing him back.
The point is, as far as being, if you have a mental illness, we can't house them with other prisoners as well for their safety or the other prisoner's safety as well. That just takes up bed spaces too. Thanks, Joe.
Al Davis, have two questions. Hopefully we could get to both of those, but nothing was said here about the theoretical tax that will come from marijuana sales. And there's a significant portion, at least as the bill stands right now, that will be allocated to counties and city police departments, depending upon the number of shops they may have or have not. So has that been, any of that been taken into account for future funding of the jail system?
That's basically a crystal ball type of thing. We don't know if it's actually ever going to take place, or it is or it isn't, or what the percentage would be. I know there's other states that are fighting that now, and I know other sheriff associations. I'm part of the Oregon State Sheriff Association, and we came out adamantly against that Measure 91 to begin with. So I don't, until it actually happens, I couldn't project what it would cost or what it would revenues would be. I don't know how else to answer that.
All right. Well, the way it's projected anyway, the percentages have been defined that may be readjusted as this bill gets further refined. But I would assume at some point you would take those into consideration.
Oh, absolutely. We'd take them into consideration.
You're not going to refuse them, I wouldn't think.
I just don't. You know, that's an unknown at this point. It's just like some of our revenue sources that we try to count on that we can't count on. For instance, I'll even give you an example. Our Marine program. We took a big hit last year. We have two Marine deputies. We're taking another big hit from the state funding this year, another 5% cut. So I'm looking at having to just go down to one Marine deputy. So you just don't know about what fundings are going to be available or not unless it's permanent.
All right. Well, thank you. If I can, one other question. We talked about the state coming in, or this referendum failing and the state taking over, the jail shutting down. Can you speak a little bit about what mechanism that would take?
Why don't you ask the commissioner? Because the sheriff has nothing to do with whether or not 3453 is implemented. It's up to the Board of Commissioners by majority vote to decide whether to ask the governor in. And if the governor comes in and they agree on a budget, half of which we pay in the county, It's up to the county commissioners to decide how that will be paid for, whether it's paid for by a add-on to your income tax, whether it's paid for by a phone tax, or any other tax that the commissioners choose to adopt. So we could have 3453 in 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, and still have a property tax to pay for the sheriff's department.
I can give you a little bit of my own opinion on that, because I did go up and meet with some other sheriffs and legislators regarding that. This has been a couple months ago, back in December. And from what I overheard them talking, the rest of the state has no sympathy for Curry County. So whether they institute something like that, like I say, it would be up to the commissioners to present it. But whether the state would actually do it, that's another, we don't know. And then it would have to be passed again by our voters, I would think. Is that right, or?
Well, whatever taxes, yes. Commissioners could say, okay, we're going to do an income tax. This thing is on.
It's like your microphones. They don't magnify, okay. They just record.
So anything we might impose or try to impose as far as a tax still is subject to referendum by the voters. So which means that the voters could force it to a ballot and have it overturned. Keep in mind, this is also an 18-month program that the state can come in and do this, and then after 18 months, tax goes away, the state goes away. They may extend it to 36 months if we request, but even if, and I personally don't think it's a good idea to invoke 3453, I don't see any long-term good effects that would come from this. I mean, come in and force a tax on folks short-term, I think we would cause more bad will than goodwill doing this. And it has to be an agreement. And they'll look at things like MOUs with other public safety departments, too. It's not going to be just strictly about how we tax the folks in the county. And it can go to referendum and be forced to a vote. So there's a lot of stuff that needs to happen for this to work. And like I said, I personally don't think it's a good idea at all.
What if it was the only way to keep the jail open?
Then what happens after 18 months when we still have no tax and it goes away? We need to find solutions that work here long term on our own.
But right now, there are no schedules.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing specific that's being suggested that is realistic, practical, available, and possible.
Well, the frustration with folks is they're tired of the property tax, and we hear that. This is, you know, John knows this as well as I do, that this is the 9th, 10th levy that's coming.
I think
folks.
My only point is, I think we're way beyond the vague idea of coming up with some solutions or long-term possibilities. We are so close to the edge of the cliff that
and we're way off topic. I just wanted to...
Out there a lot. We're going to receive, and this is from OLCC, maybe $90,000 a year in revenue from the marijuana. We're General Law County, we can't tax. So that's why you haven't seen the commissioners bring a tax on marijuana, because we can't. The city can't charge. We're General Law, we're not allowed to do that. So we'll have to go on how that formally works out. OLCC thinks it's going to be about $90,000 a year. That will pay for one patrol deputy if that's where the money goes. So. It's not a benefit to the county right now, unless something changes.
Just a footnote on the comment about the jails back east. I was in two of those 1800s county houses of correction. The one in the county I lived in, I was there to visit a prisoner, not as a prisoner. The second one, Suffolk County, is now known as the Liberty Hotel. And you're all welcome to go in to the drunk tank there and have a drink, because it's now a very fashionable bar. But I've also toured our jail, and if you look at what is important in a building, our building wasn't built in the 1890s, but it's not in better condition than those buildings were. The Suffolk County, when it was closed down by federal court order, and Essex County, when we were fortunate enough to build a new jail, and sell it to a developer. It's now a restaurant, I believe. Think of what we could call the hotel restaurant down the street if it closes. Any other questions? Debate? Comment? Yes, Jack.
Jack Pruitt-Port Orford. I'd like to make some comments about the importance of having a 24-hour road patrol. I'm a retired firefighter from Detroit. I spent 15 years on the Detroit Fire Department. And on several times when we responded to a fire, the police department had already been there. They had been there. And in sometimes they had pulled people out of buildings. So the importance is having somebody on patrol. Now, would it make a difference all the time? We don't know that. But possibly it could make a difference having that road patrol responding there before the fire department does. Especially out here, we have volunteer fire departments, which takes much longer to get out of the house than when you're a professional firefighter living in the quarters. Of course, at night, you're in bed, you have to jump up, put on your gear, get on a rig, and out you go. The patrol car, they're out in the street. They get their message from central office. They're there to the fire long before we get there. And like I said, they've done good on several different times. That's why it's important, I think, to have guys on the patrol all the time.
Hi, I'm Connie Hunter, and excuse me for not standing, but I also have to apologize for abandoning my post as a tech person. Thank you, Tom, for picking up the slack, and Jim Newman. I wanted to be able to make this comment and not be, I'm here as a private citizen, is what I'm saying, instead of with the radio station, so I can make this comment. It's unconscionable that we should think that we don't have enough backup out there for our men and women on patrol, period. And so I endorse the levy for all the reasons that have come forward in a positive way today. But beyond that, I fully believe that if we don't take the good approach and the right approach to providing what our law enforcement officers need, our deputies need out there in the real world, that we're failing as a county. So if a law enforcement district is where we need to go, let's go there. Let's not hold back the horses on this. It's time. It's time.
I think listening to the excellent presentation from both Joel and Sheriff Ward, that we can really see the need, and certainly we don't want to be without law enforcement. And well, we live in the city of Brookings, but we want county protection because we do leave the city once in a while. So, you know, we really want the protection. I think most people really do, but when you talk to various people, various citizens, voters, they're really concerned about how they're going to pay more property tax. And that is a real problem, especially in our economy nowadays. So I can empathize with them when they go, well, you know, I can't afford any more property tax. And it's easy for us to say that, well, you know, it's not going to be that big. We can pay it, some Subway sandwiches or whatever, but some people really don't have that means. And I'm wondering, I at one time heard one of our friends say that there is a state program to help, that's a loan or something. I'm thinking if there are any programs to help people who really need it with property taxes, whether it's a long-term loan, I think it's one sort of like a reverse mortgage type of thing, but that people might consider that if they knew there are possible programs out there, if they really, I mean, you know, if they really are struggling, that maybe they'd be more willing to vote for it. So maybe if, you know, something were more publicized about if there is a way. I don't know much about it, but I have heard via the grapevine that there's something to help people with.
That's a little bit above my pay grade.
But I mean, if I don't know, if somebody could make that known.
But I think Carl could probably respond to that.
There is a program in Oregon. There's programs in most states that allow a couple who are in financial distress and in a home and have no place else to go, that they can accrue. Their real estate taxes accrue, and then when either they leave or sell, the county or the municipality gets paid. Most of them have reasonable interest rates, and there are other programs. I'm not familiar with Oregon, but I know in Massachusetts, their veterans, disabled veterans, a lot of people got exemptions from part of the real estate tax that lessened the burden on them. So there are programs. There's nothing that prevents people in the county from setting up a new nonprofit to which people could contribute and then setting up a means to distribute those funds to the people that really need them. Any other comments, suggestions?
Just a quick comment is, I can't ever imagine a television series where a police department had to go beg for money. Just my personal observation.
Oh wait, we have one more comment. Becky?
I'd like to say I'm supportive of what I've heard here today. However, what assurance is if this referendum fully passed, and you got funded over the 3-year period, what assurance is there that what the main contacts here I've heard is there are going to be more patrol people on duty? Okay, you get funded, and as you mentioned earlier, your Marine division goes down by one person, or they can't do it. So are these funds that have been endorsed by the public, with the main thought in mind, at least as I understand it, more patrol people, deputies on duty? You've suggested 5 or 6 additional people. You know, now does the priority become, well, I've got to replace the Marine guy, and so we'll decrease our patrol people. So a year from now, or whenever it is, we're back to only 1 or 2 additional people put on because of allocation difficulties.
We built this into the budget to fund the majority of the Marine and the Forest Patrol positions in case those go away. So I'm hoping that we don't have to lose any deputies. If it's stable, we shouldn't have to lose any.
From my point of view, I would say that should be your number one priority, to fulfill an obligation which is really in the public eye and what people are hoping for. I realize you have a lot of other things to cover, but I would be very much disappointed if we ended up with one extra deputy after 2 years' time.
Absolutely, I would too. I'm going to go out on a limb. Well, not go on a limb. I'm going to just tell you, I'm going to hire those deputies. I will get them up and I will get them trained. The problem is, once we do that, is keeping them maintained here, because we're basically been a training ground here because we haven't had no stability for to bring their families here and live here. They get trained and they move off to get a better job, higher paying job, better benefits. You know, but if we can provide stable funding here, there's no reason why they should leave. We have a beautiful place here.
I just have one question. How much does it cost for a bulletproof vest?
Roughly right around $800.
Okay.
I'd be a little remiss. Did you want to say something about that?
Well, my question, answer to your question, is more confrontational than the sheriff's. In May of 2016, we will all have an opportunity to judge whether, if the levy passes, it's being used or abused, because 2 of the members of the Board of Commissioners will be up for re-election or there'll be vacancies. And I think even the sheriff is up for election in May of 2016. So, you know, I view this as taking a year and a half back. You know, I'll bet a year and a half of higher taxes to have the sheriff's department here in 5 years. I'm not concerned.
We're going to be transparent. We're going to be open. Everything that we do is going to be accountable to the community because they're paying for it. We'll have our own, when we get our district form, we'll have our own citizen advisory board on that, that works with the governing board and have it a budget committees and everything to make sure that we, every penny that we spend is accountable for. We're trying to take take a nickel and get a dime's work out of it, you know, so.
Speaking for Democrats in Curry County, that's why we're asking how much a vest would cost. It's not easy being a Democrat.
Introduce your
I'd be remiss if I didn't introduce my lieutenant, because he's well experienced, and he's come from an agency that were facing huge layoffs because of financial issues, and how they developed and brought their department to one of the finest ones in the state of Oregon. Lieutenant Mike Espinoza, I'm going to have him just come up and introduce himself and give you his little take on why we need what we need.
Thank you, guys. It's a privilege and honor to be in the room with you guys today. I'm very honored to have you guys spend your Saturday to come here and discuss the things that we're going through and make an informed decision. And I hope that informed decision is that you'll support what we're trying to do. I've been in this business for 23 years. This will be my 23rd year. And I've always worked in a sheriff's office. And what I can tell you in working in a sheriff's office is this. A sheriff's office is unique because a sheriff's office always, always will have a relationship and partnership with the community they serve. They're the chief law enforcement agency for all citizens, as you've heard, throughout the county, and rural patrols are much different. And I'm not slamming my brothers in blue who work in the city or the Oregon State Police, but county sheriff's responsibilities go well beyond what many people know. And to answer your question, ma'am, here's a guarantee. When we get fully functional staffing, we're gonna have people not only in your area, but they will know the specific needs of your area. They will know the expectations of your neighborhood, your city, or your unincorporated area. The areas up north may have completely different expectations as they have in Harbor. And our officers in Harbor will know the expectations there, and they will meet those expectations. And I think you said something, sir, about what can we guarantee? Will there be people lost? No, we're gonna fund Marine Patrol. You'll have Marine Patrol. And it'll be our goal to have the best Marine Patrol we can, because the waterways here, every year we have tragic accidents. So it's important that we have people that remain here. If you look at the Marine Patrol we have now, the history those two have, we can't lose it. And so what we are asking for is sustainability. And I want you to take that bet, that year and a half bet. Matter of fact, I want you to take it a three-year bet. And here's what I'm going to guarantee you with a three-year bet. We're going to provide you the best service that you've had. We're not providing you a service right now that you deserve. Why? Because we're short, we're hamstrung. And actually, what we do every day is we try to squeeze, you know, a nickel out of every penny we got in that budget. We look at every car, we look at every piece of equipment. We think if we're going to buy, you know, we were down the other day talking about somebody ran too many copies of the copier. That's a big deal to us. We're just like anybody on a fixed income. That's a big deal to us right now. To answer some of the questions about the jail, why did we reduce it? That's called liability management. Once we have an inmate in our custody, they are our inmate. That's like a daycare. I hate to use that analogy. I don't want to make the correlation. But when you put your child in a daycare, you want your child coming home safe. You want your child coming home, you know, healthy. We have inmates in there. It is our responsibility to do this. To get them to court, they're alleged to have committed an act, to provide them adequate health insurance, to provide them adequate meals, to provide them safety and security. We cannot afford to have one death over there. Okay? I can't afford that. As the operations lieutenant, I can't afford that. I have 25 people in custody over there right now. If you look at the military and you said, hey, we're gonna go out on an operation, 10% casualties in the military right now is probably, would you agree, Connie? About right? So if I came in there and said, well, we got one body bag for one of the inmates. Unacceptable. Absolutely unacceptable. Why? Because the lawsuit that we will incur will be greater than the county's entire budget. So what I have is I have young staff with 2 years average, tasked with taking care of these people 24/7. They're detoxing on heroin, detoxing on alcohol, detoxing on methamphetamine. They've come in at the worst of the worst. They've just committed their crime. We bring them in, we assess them, we ask questions, and then we take care of them. And so when you say, how many beds do you have? That really doesn't matter in the equation. I could have 100 beds, but I may not use 100 because I've got 75 people with 75 different dilemmas, and I can't house them together, so those beds really don't matter. Those pods don't matter. So why we reduced it is this. We were told after the levy failed, and I hate to go off and get on a soapbox, shut the jail down. Shut it down. That'll show them. My suggestion to the sheriff, humbly, was this. Let's reduce it down to a workable number to where we can safely manage it. We will not refuse an arrest. You arrest them, bring them to us, we'll evaluate it. We will not refuse, and we will still keep public safety. But what we can do, because what we knew at the time was, at June, we were out of money. So sometime before June, we had to give what you're called layoff notices. And sometimes people who work for you, knowing that the end of the rope's coming, don't stay. So why not get the inmates down to a workable level, anticipating potential layoffs, anticipating staff leaving, anticipating other liabilities, so that we can still do our main function, and that's provide public safety, try to save money where we can by lowering the inmate levels and not creating so many liabilities and reevaluating that jail. The other side of this, what I'll tell you, is very frustrating. In my 23 years, I had the privilege and honor to work through a lot of different assignments. At one point, I had 104 people working under me. I worked assignments where I had 15 patrol people under me. You know, I have not been in a situation like I am right now, but I'm committed to this, and I truly believe we're going to reach this, and this will be historical. Here's the problem. I know he doesn't go home at night. I know Joel doesn't go home at night, and I know I don't go home at night thinking, all right, put the ball game, have a little dinner, and here we go. Because it's either 9, 10, 11, 3, I get that call. And the last thing I think about when I get that call is, well, you're not paying your fair share of taxes. You don't like what I do. You've downed me in the opinion on the paper. No, my thing is, wipe it out of your eyes, get your head clear, and let's get going. Where's this at? In the last 3 weeks, we've had calls where it's like, no, we got to go right now. Tragedy, a complete tragedy, fire. Horrible. Go to the worst thing that you can think about. Who do you think talks to the little girl? Me and the detective. Shots fired. We're going to look for a person. You go out that night, right? I'm out there with the deputies too. Limited deputies. He's out there. Nobody's talking about pay. Nobody's talking about what isn't going on. Nobody's talking about how long this thing will last. All we know is that's our job. We will go dig in a rabbit hole for this person and not think twice and then go home and then put it back on the next day. That's where we're going out to be. I would rather have boots on the ground, cars out in the street 24/7 so you never have to deal with that. So there is no delay in that response. And I understand how people feel about this. I understand that. You know, I've lived life. I've had homes. I've had, you know, I want someday to have a retirement and to have the ability to have a life after this career. But what I will tell you is this. This is money well spent. Any vital community has some commonalities. They have good quality education. They have good quality public safety. And the community is looking for ways to improve their livelihoods. The businesses, those things, those all come together. I truly believe we have to get this straightened out. You know, we have living wage jobs. They don't make a whole lot in there, but they shop in this community. Their kids go to school in this community. They play sports in this community. They recreate in this community. And we can bring other people into the community who do that, who want to be representative of the community. So that's another thing that you look at. So some of that tax money we're spending is recycling right back through. Their wives, their children, their others may develop other businesses here. They'll get involved, but that's the kind of things we need to look at. It isn't just about public safety and 24/7 patrol. There's a bigger picture here. And in order for us to provide what we want to provide to you, we have to be whole. We have to have that foundational ground to work from. And as an operations manager, it drives me crazy because I look at the liability management daily. That is my biggest concern daily. And I'll ask Joe when we come in, who's on duty in your jail? What's going on with your guys in the jail? I'll ask patrol, how many reports are you down? Did we do this? Did you do that? You know, and we go and run and do what we can. Port Orford, there were some folks here in Port Orford. You know, it wasn't the other morning I checked on. It wasn't a minute after I checked on, he's going to a dispute in progress by himself. I'm hustling up there to back him up. I don't care if he's in the city. What I was frustrated is I didn't have a deputy right there closer than me to do it right then and there so that we don't have that delay. We don't need that delay. That delay is what hurts us. I guarantee you we will have 24/7 patrol. And here's another guarantee I'm going to give you on your bet. Okay? We are going to do things A to Z.
You're recording this.
Yep, you're recording this. I hope you are. Hold me accountable. You're going to get services from A to Z. You're going to get follow-up, and we are coming to your door. You're going to get the cop you want to have at your front door, if not call me. And I've already told the deputies this. No longer will there be phone contacts unless absolutely necessary. No longer will someone send in a report to our office that says, these bad things happen and bother me. And we go, well, okay, let's put it under there and let's go to this. No. We're going to go to calls for service and you're going to provide them a public service. And it is your sheriff's office. Bottom line, it's your sheriff's office. You create the expectations. It is our obligation to meet those expectations and go beyond. That's what I want to see. And we will hire people to do that. We will provide them equipment, training, and everything else so that they have a viable option, and that is a job. And we want to make that job sustainable. And then we want to grow these people so they'll become your leaders in the future. We're not all going to be here forever. We're not. Sheriff's not going to be here, myself, Sergeant Handley. But right now, what the scary thing is when you have an average of 2 years on, what history, what experience, what levels of service can they provide you if they're that limited? So we've got to really grow. There's a big picture here. And that's what I want to do. So the monies that come in, trust me, we're already thinking of where we can go. But the problem is we also have to think about our daily obligations, our responsibilities daily. But I promise you, you'll get one of the finer agencies in the state and in your community, guaranteed. I mean, those things are coming. And that's what we want to do with it. We are not doing this just to, you know, pad our pockets or things like that. I think anybody who knows anything about sheriff's offices knows we understand when you sign on and you say yes and we pass that, me and you are in a partnership. It is my obligation to make sure I deliver services to you the way you want them in your community. And then I got to do that in your community and any other communities that you work in. That has to be throughout the entire organization. And I guarantee you will get that. Guarantee you will get that. All right, thank you for your time.
Do you want me to wrap it up? Or?
Sure. Does anybody else got any more questions?
Connie?
She always has another question.
I don't think anybody in the room can not see the personal resolve of our sheriff's office individuals. We did the tour of the jail for KCIW radio, I was allowed to see a lot that I didn't know about. I encourage all of us to remember two things, that freedom comes with responsibility, and my freedom to move about the county in a safe way is protected by the sheriff's office. I appreciate that. I have one question. For Lieutenant Espinoza, we have one thing in common beyond this place, and that's being a Yankees fan.
That's out of order.
So I couldn't not go away without creating a little controversy. So how do I collect a debt of $566,000 up from are we going to say in a San Francisco Giants fan?
Terry.
One last thing. I hear all the time from the different cities is, okay, we have police officers, why should we pay an additional amount of money for additional sheriffs? Remember, if the police officer arrests somebody, they've got to go to the jail. And each city does not have a jail. We only have one county jail. They've got to come here, and so we have to have staff, and we have to provide all the things that not only the Oregon State says, but what the federal government says that the inmates are required to have. And also, again, as a community, we need to support the sheriff. And if it costs us $2.52 in the county, in the unincorporated area, $1.34 more in the city to have it, I think it's money well worth spent. Thank you.
I think we come close to the end. I do have to offer, Lieutenant, I have sitting at home a set of CDs of the 2004 Yankees-Red Sox series. I've watched the three games that the good team lost. I'm about to start the four games that the Red Sox won, if you'd like to join me.
I would only ask that you return the favor and you watch the other 27.
Okay, we're gonna let's take, you know, I'd like to take two votes, and first it's just a straw vote of everyone in the room, and how the Curry County Democratic Central Committee votes on an endorsement is that notice of our doing this was in last month's meeting and this month's meeting, and our policy requires an affirmative vote of 2/3 of the members voting, but not fewer than 10 affirmative votes. And to do that vote, I have a list of the members up here. And so after we do the straw votes, if the members would circle through and could I see, yeah, just a show of hands, how many here are going to vote yes for 881?
Is this everyone or just
everyone?
vote off.
As a Democrat, I can declare that a unanimous vote, I think, whether it was or not. But it was, it certainly looked like it was unanimous. And so, Sheriff and your staff, I thank you.
Thank you, Carol.
That was a tremendous presentation. We hope to do this again in May with, hopefully we don't have to talk about how do we survive the failure of the levy, but I think it's still important to meet after the vote and talk about how the rest of the county goes forward, and we'll at least invite all three commissioners to that meeting. So if, with no further ado, again, if everyone's welcome to stay until the vote is counted, but if the members will pass by the podium and check the right box, and the sheriff has one more comment.
Just real quick, I did have a talk with the Rotary up in Port Orford, had a unanimous, basically, support of their city council. I talked to them. They also voted to support the levy. And I'm going to be talking to the Brookings City Council Monday night, and then Gold Beach's City Council. And everybody expects that they're going to follow Port Orford's lead as far as passing a city ordinance, but resolution to support the levy. So I'm very optimistic about that.
This concludes our coverage of this special town hall meeting. If you like this program and want to hear more like it, consider supporting Curry Coast Community Radio and help us get on the air. For more information, go to our website, kciw.org. Thank you for listening.